Hey everyone, and welcome to this, a feature podcast presentation brought to you by the Hewlett Foundation. My name's Patrick Gray. This podcast was supposed to be up last week, late last week, but it was delayed. Long story short, I had a flu shot last week and it actually really knocked me about for a day. So I wasn't able to finish this off. I'm all fine now, though, and by the time you hear this, I will be on leave. So, yay! See you in a couple of weeks. Anyway, this is the first edition of a new series of podcasts we're doing here at Risky Biz that will focus on cyber policy issues. The Hewlett Foundation approached us a while back to see if we'd be interested in doing this series. And I jumped at the opportunity. The foundation funds a lot of interesting people and work in the cybersecurity space. So the idea behind these podcasts is pretty simple. We can talk to some of its grant recipients or experts in Hewlett's network about pressing policy issues and turn those conversations into podcasts. And the whole idea is to get some policy perspectives out there among the Risky Biz audience, which, funnily enough, includes a lot of policy people. And our first cab off the rank in this new series is this interview with Jim Baker. He joined the Department of Justice in 1990 and rose through the ranks to become the FBI General Counsel in January 2014, a position he held until December 2017. So, of course, he was running all things legal for the FBI during the Apple FBI dispute over that locked iPhone 5C recovered from the gunman responsible for the San Bernardino shooting in California. Baker was the US government's point man on all things encryption, taking stances that outraged technologists and reinvigorated a policy debate that had, at least to a degree, stagnated for years. These days, Jim Baker serves as director of the R Street think tank's National Security and Cybersecurity Program. Now, before we get going, I want to talk a little bit of background here and actually share an opinion on what this debate has looked like to me as an observer of it over the years. And it hasn't looked good, really, in my view, for many people on either side. On one side, we have various governments screaming that the sky is falling because end-to-end encryption and robust at-rest encryption on mobile devices, you know, are coming to eat your children. And on the other side, we have technologists claiming that any laws compelling cooperation from technology providers is like evidence of the rise of the Fourth Reich. But, you know, it's possible that there is a center to this debate and that useful conversations can actually be had here. And I'll give you an example of that. Australia's Assistance and Access Bill has been the source of a lot of controversy here in Australia and indeed around the world. And I've been on record saying, you know, in my view, that it's a bad law, and I still believe it is. But if we're going to have a real discussion about this bill, it is my view that people should at least understand what it's trying to accomplish, what its scope is. And it's not about putting a backdoor on every device. It's not anti-encryption legislation per se. So, like, you know, are the protections in the bill against backdooring insufficient? Yes. Is the crime seriousness threshold for the bill too low? You know, at offences carrying 3 years of imprisonment or more? Again, I would say yes. Are there other problems with it? Absolutely yes. But the intent of that bill and what it's designed to do, at least as far as I understand it, they don't really match what people are saying it is. A Guardian journalist here in Australia, Paul Karp, he actually FOI'd the Law Enforcement and Intelligence Agency guide to the Assistance and Access Bill, and I've uploaded a copy to the Risky Biz servers because he didn't link to it from anywhere, but I've linked to it from this podcast post if you'd like to take a read. It's a really interesting look at how agencies are intending to use this legislation, and it's less about busting E2E and more about stuff other than that. It will make sense when you read the guide and have a look at some of the example use cases. Could that bill be used to do something bad down the track? Yeah, it could, right? And that's why I think it's a bad law. But I still think that document is worth reading if this is a topic that you're interested about. But look, both sides of this debate are kind of guilty of hyperbole. That's my point. Some technologists are saying to give an inch is the end of the world, and some government voices are demanding tech companies just fix the going dark problem. Just wave a magic wand and fix it somehow. Well, as you're about to hear, Jim Baker's position on this matter is actually quite nuanced. He absolutely accepts that any solution that we introduce that would help law enforcement deal with issues like E2E or locked devices, those solutions will carry risks. He acknowledges that. But right now, he says, the latest battle in the crypto war has essentially ended in a stalemate. Here's what Jim Baker had to say.
I think a stalemate in the United States, yeah, we'll just stick with that for a moment. I think a stalemate actually, for better or worse, is the right way to think about it. There's no immediate prospect, I think, in the United States of having this issue. I'll use the word resolved because some people think it is resolved, but let's just say that it is where it is. I don't see it moving dramatically in any direction in the United States anytime soon. And what I mean by that is what would really be required to move it would be some type of change to U.S. federal law. And that's what would change substantially the situation on the ground.
This is something that in my mind kicked off around 2008 with the Mumbai attacks, where the attackers were using BlackBerries for on-the-ground comms, you know, a commercial tool. That really rattled the Indian government and, in my mind, kicked all of this off. But it was a different experience there, wasn't it, in that this hit the agenda based on a major, you know, in the context of a major terrorist attack, whereas the U.S. hasn't really had that experience.
Well, so I want to be careful not to discuss particular instances where encryption has been a problem with devices and so on, obviously with the exception of Apple, and I'm assuming we'll talk about that. But just the basic idea is this is a problem that has been growing over time. And part of it has played out in the public, but law enforcement, national security authorities in the United States, around the world, have been dealing with this problem for a significant amount of time. It has increased significantly over the past few years, but it's a problem we've been dealing with for a while. The public just hasn't seen it.
Mm. It's a difficult one, isn't it? Because if you would like to better represent your position to the public, that's a hard thing to do when you're dealing with what are inherently secretive matters.
Exactly. No, it's been terrible because on the one hand, yes, we wanted to alert and still do want to alert the public as to the basic nature of the problem, but we can't give too many specifics because that would especially tell our adversaries, the bad guys, basically, what it is that we can't do. And, you know, our fear is sort of like moths to a flame. If we tell them, oh, we can't do this particular service, well, then they'll gravitate toward that.
Yeah, and maybe, I mean, if you say the problem, we have a terrible time with Telegram or a terrible time with Signal, it is a bit of a green light, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. And I'm not going to confirm or deny those particular services, but I'll just say that that's been the dilemma that law enforcement, public safety officials have faced for some particular time. How do we achieve the sufficient amount of transparency so the public can be aware of what the problem is, so that lawmakers can decide what to do, if anything, and yet not give away our limitations, our vulnerabilities, our weaknesses to our adversaries.
Now, it seems like in the case of Apple versus FBI, the FBI essentially went into a public relations and marketing war with Apple, which, given that they are the best at those two things, you know, it feels like you're not going to win that one. And certainly the FBI didn't appear to win the PR and you know, the hearts and minds in that whole episode. Would you agree with that? That the perception is, because it seems to me that the perception out there is that, you know, laws or case law that would seek to make law enforcement's job easier is a power grab. That seems to be the perception. Do you agree that that is a perception problem for U.S. authorities?
It's a perception problem. I mean, I guess I would disagree with the notion that this was about marketing PR. We're not in that business, and I think Apple would disagree in terms of how they thought they were marketing or presenting these products at that particular time in terms of, you know, this is not something that they were trying to use to obtain a competitive advantage over other people in the market. But in any event, but the bottom line, your fundamental point, well, I guess I would disagree in some sense. Look, the American people hire the FBI to do a job, and the FBI works for the American people. And it does what the American people wanted to do with the tools that the American people give the FBI through their elected representatives in Congress. So our obligation at a minimum was to identify to the public what the nature and scope of the problem was. We, in this particular case, in the Apple case involving the terrorist attack in San Bernardino, which a number of people were killed and injured, we felt a solemn obligation to the victims to their families and to any potential other victims that might be out there, you know, if there had been co-conspirators or other people involved in the plot. We felt an obligation to those people to do everything we could within the bounds of the law to follow up on logical leads. And so that's what we did. By trying to get into the that particular Apple phone, we were trying to see whether there were any investigative leads on the device that we, you know, that would lead us somewhere, tell us what the motive was, tell if there were co-conspirators, tell us anything else about the case that would make sense that normal investigators would do in such a situation.
It's an interesting one in that, you know, and I don't really want to get bogged down in Apple v. FBI in this conversation, because it seems to me that that one was kind of an edge case in that you had a dead suspect with essentially an obsolete piece of technology. It was a special case, wasn't it, that doesn't really apply even to the debate as it stands now a few years later.
Well, I'm not so sure about that because, look, counting the number of devices that U.S. law enforcement and national security authorities run into every year that we cannot open has proven to be not easy to do. And we've made mistakes at that in terms of, we, the FBI, have made mistakes about that in reporting some of the data in the past. But I believe it is accurate to say in a general way that no, there are a number of devices every year that federal, state, and local authorities in the United States cannot open. And that has some impact. It's difficult to quantify, but it has some impact on the progress of investigations, on our ability to resolve them quickly and accurately and thoroughly. So it's still a problem.
Yeah.
Still a problem.
Yeah, I just wonder if the remedy from that, because we've got really two issues here. We've got, you know, end-to-end messenger-based, you know, encryption as a challenge for law enforcement, but also as a very privacy-enhancing feature for the general public. And then we've got the issue of seized devices. And at least from a technology point of view, those are two very different problems. I just wonder, though, the obvious question to me is whether or not the remedy for the seized devices problem might be laws that allow authorities to compel decryption. Is that not something that you can really ramp up in the United States because of laws around self-incrimination, things like that?
The laws of self-incrimination have been an issue, but I think it's more fundamental than that. So you're right. There are two fundamental problems. Data in motion, data at rest, right? So data as it's being transmitted back and forth and being encrypted, that is a particular problem in a set of cases where we're interested, where we don't have access to a device, a particular, you know, a particular smartphone or a computer or something like that, but we might be able to intercept the communications. We do so pursuant to a lawful authorization, and then we can't decrypt them because they were encrypted in transmission. That's one problem. And then the other problem, as you say, is on the devices, the stored data, and that's a different set of problems. Which one is easier or not, it's a bit tricky. I mean, in some of the efforts that I've been involved in to try to address this problem, both within inside government and outside, we have tended to focus on the stored device, on the device that the FBI or another agency might be able to actually get their hands on and to figure out whether we can open that. So that's generally believed by technologists to be a more manageable problem to solve, but still not easy.
It's interesting you say that because, you know, in my view, it's kind of almost the other way around, right? Because when you're dealing with a stored, you know, with a device that you have in your possession that is encrypted with these, you know, latest technologies where the passphrase, you know, into the device is essentially used to generate the key. The only solution there seems to be something like, you know, Ray Ozzie's proposal, which was really pushed forward by law enforcement as a sort of solution to this, but what really looked to technologists like a key escrow scheme, more or less. So that is the perception, is it, among sort of law enforcement and intelligence circles that the priority problem is the locked devices issue?
It's a good question. It depends who you talk to. It depends on the context, I guess I would say. In certain circumstances, depending upon the sophistication of the adversary, they might be using and doing a good job of it, using end-to-end encrypted messaging apps or something like that, that really makes it difficult for us to do our jobs. That could be a significant problem. It depends on the type of bad guy that you're going after. The smartphones, the handheld devices that are encrypted, they're so common nowadays that it does impact law enforcement and the ability to fight crime and do
investigations. So that being the issue that like every single criminal now uses that by default.
Yeah, basically, right. And so they have very well done, high quality encryption on devices if they choose to engage it. And not every criminal puts a passcode on a device. That does happen, that we get in when they don't have it. So, but many of them do, sophisticated ones especially. And so, yeah, that's one type of problem that we run into. Yeah.
Okay,
encryption
so
is much broader than that too. It's, it's used in all kinds of different contexts. We encounter that from time to time too, depending on the type of bad guy that we're dealing with.
So again, like why is the remedy for that problem? And that's why I didn't want to get so much bogged into Apple v. FBI, because
sure,
in that case, the suspect was dead. But surely if that suspect had been taken alive, the remedy there could have been quite strong laws saying you are charged with a serious crime, and we're seeking to collect more evidence. You must unlock this device or the penalty is quite severe. Why is it that isn't a policy remedy to this problem in most circumstances?
Because it probably won't work in some circumstances. If somebody is a suspect in a murder case, and the choice in the United States could be between the death penalty or sitting in jail for a while, the judge waits for you to decide to open the phone, then they'll choose, I'll just sit in jail. They can't keep me in jail forever under this, at least in the United States, under this kind of a theory. And so, if I'm facing a murder charge or, somebody's a suspect in producing child pornography, the penalties for that are quite severe in the United States. And so they'll take their chances. They'll just sit it out and try to, hey, put me in jail for that. I'll be in for less time for refusing to open the device than if you convict me of child pornography production, and I'll sit in jail for the rest of my life. So it is an instrument that could work in certain circumstances, but not in all, is our assessment.
When we're talking about messaging, we've got to break it down into two parts, I feel, where you've got the metadata issue and you've got the content issue. And investigators that I've spoken to, I've asked them, if you had the choice between content and metadata, what would you choose? And they all say metadata every time. Do you think that's an oversimplification, or do you think that it's possible that with slightly better cooperation from communications providers, that metadata access might be enough to assist investigators enough so that this is less of an issue?
Well, it depends what you mean by enough, I guess. So yes, metadata is highly useful. The FBI and other law enforcement agencies, national security agencies use it in the United States. It's highly probative. It produces good leads. In that particular case, as you mentioned, that might, if you looked at the metadata, it might enable you to figure out who that other person was. It's highly useful. But in certain circumstances, the content is what matters. It's very difficult to prosecute somebody in a criminal case in the United States and put them in jail on the basis of metadata. It is done, but it's challenging. And the content, when you have the actual words that the criminals are saying to each other, is much more probative, especially about criminal intent. That's one of the hardest things to prove often in a criminal case. And the metadata might tell you about intent, but it may not. And the content is just going to be critically important. Also, especially like in a terrorism context where you're trying to prevent something, yes, the metadata will be very informative about the network that the person is connected to and so on. But actually, with respect to what they might be plotting and when they might try to pull something off, it's usually the content that's going to be helpful, even if they're speaking in code, which happens all the time. But we can often figure out what it is that they're talking about just because we're doing a thorough investigation. We can essentially decode what they're saying. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it is the case, right, that metadata is great for investigations, but content is what gets convictions, I guess, is what you're saying there.
That's one way to put it. I mean, that's not universally true. Metadata can get convictions sometimes. It depends what the metadata is. But it's just the problem is there's no single solution for all of this. That's what we keep running into. Sometimes metadata works. Sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes content works when metadata doesn't. And so it's just it complicates the issue. And there's, this is what is so vexing about this encryption problem. There's no clear, simple technological or law enforcement answer that fits in every case, because criminals are crafty and they do lots of different things to evade surveillance and evade law enforcement and stay out of jail.
So it seems to me there's two factors that might have helped to get us here. One is the leak of material from NSA by Edward Snowden, which showed that it was possible to intercept in bulk messages over networks. So that really pushed technology companies toward end-to-end messaging. First of all, would you agree that that document release has factored into the debate here?
Well, I don't want to exactly say or confirm anything exactly with respect to what Snowden disclosed. But I will say that, yes, in general, the Snowden matter resulted in a marked increase in the rollout of encryption across different platforms, different devices, and so on. It definitely accelerated the issue for us.
Mm. So, as you would know, in Australia, we, recently passed a bill named the Assistance and Access Bill, and it was slightly controversial. I guess it did receive some mainstream attention, but generally people were quite accepting of the government's need to, bolster its powers in this area. It seems like in the United States, there's a lot more resistance to any policy proposals that would result in more powers for authorities in that area. Do you think that some of the resistance here, in the US in particular, comes down to the general population's suspicious attitude towards government and law enforcement? I just wonder about that, because it seems like people in the US are particularly hostile to the idea that law enforcement might have find a so-called solution here,
Well, I mean, I think people are and should be concerned about their privacy. That's important. People should be skeptical of their government. I said that when I was in government. I've said it since then. The government has a lot of power, and Americans historically have been skeptical about power concentrated in the hands of government. And that makes sense to me. I understand that. That's why we have things like, in the United States, the Fourth Amendment that limits the ability of the government to conduct searches. So that makes sense. I mean, the question really is, it's a set of choices, and what risks are the American people willing to undertake as a society in order to obtain freedom and maintain their privacy? There are risks associated with that. There are risks associated with encryption. There are collateral consequences associated with encryption. It makes it harder for the FBI and other law enforcement and national security agencies to conduct investigations. Sometimes we will not solve crimes. Sometimes we will not be able to get to a victim as quickly as we might otherwise have. That may or may not result in a threat to life.
Mm.
I'm not going to say in every case it's going to, but I'm saying that slowing down law enforcement is one of the effects of encryption.
Mm.
And as a society, what we're trying to do is tell society, like the American society in this case, we have this problem. You will have the following consequences if we can't deal with encryption. You need to decide through your elected representatives whether you want that to be the case or whether you want to change the circumstances.
And what would you say to someone who says, yes, look, I understand the risks. I understand that these are the consequences, but I'm making an informed choice here? Because it does seem like the people who are against this stuff recognize, to a degree at least, they recognize that, there are drawbacks here. I guess the question becomes, like, how informed do you think that calculation is on behalf of the voting public right now?
Yeah, I don't think it's that. I'm not going to say it's not that informed. I think, to be fair, the American people have a general sense of the issue. I think what people often don't focus on is that, my ability to have enhanced privacy because of encryption, and I am very happy to have my data protected. Don't get me wrong. I mean, the FBI sees, and then, I personally and the FBI, when I was there, saw the huge value to society about encryption. We're not so all against encryption. It definitely is beneficial. But the reality is that, when it benefits some people, when encryption benefits some people because it protects their privacy, it may push off costs onto other people who may be innocent victims who had no part in any of this encryption debate, but who are the victims of somebody who's used an encrypted device, and they will suffer the consequences. So it's rarely the people that are, that's not fair. The people who get the benefits from encryption are not always going to be the people who suffer the cost or who potentially could suffer the cost. It could be innocent.
Yeah.
I don't know if you have children victims who have nothing to do with any of this debate and who can't consent to anything. if they're the people that end up being victims. Now, I know I'll take a lot of heat for mentioning children because people usually get upset when we do that. But the reality is the FBI and other public safety officials have to protect children who are often victimized. Anyway.
Well, and I think, it's personal as well, right? Because I have known a bunch of investigators and it's crimes against children that really get them fired up, and for good reason.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, exactly. And then that's what, back to San Bernardino, just real quick. I mean, that was a heinous crime and there were real victims. And we felt obligated as investigators doing our jobs to pursue that case as far as the law would allow us to do.
Look, not that you'll care and not that it's relevant to this conversation, but I thought that whole thing was quite weird. It just seemed a strange place for Apple to dig in. As far as I was concerned, as someone who's covered this for a long time, I mean, there's an argument to be had, there's a debate to be had. I just thought it was very curious that they chose to have it there. Although, their point was that this was somehow precedent setting. I mean, what would you say to that? Force them into a position where a precedent would be set and then it could be used for other things.
I think that's true. That's absolutely true. And we didn't question the good faith of Apple. They don't want their devices used for unlawful purposes. No way. I mean, they're law-abiding Americans who want their devices used for good purposes. They don't want them used for bad purposes. And, so they were operating good faith. They just had a belief about the importance of that case and the long-term implications of it that differed from our assessment of it. And
do you believe that it would have set a precedent?
Yes. If we had been able to so let's just back up real quick. In that particular case, without getting too much in the weeds, we got a search warrant from a judge to search the phone. And then we also got a separate order under something called the All Writs Act in the United States, the statute that allows the government to get an order to tell a third party to do something to help us with the case. And in this case, we got an order under the All Writs Act to Apple to tell them, hey, you have to unlock the phone. And so that's what we really were fighting about. And their view was that statute doesn't allow you to force us to do this kind of a thing. We disagreed. It didn't get resolved because of this a third party that came in and helped us open the phone. But had it gone to court and had we won, yes, we would have absolutely used that in subsequent cases as a precedent.
Yeah. So look, it seems to me, it certainly seems to me that people in the, among my own flock, right, the technologists are tend to ignore the arguments of law enforcement here a little too much, right? I'm going to say that's true. But conversely, right, I would also say that people in the policy side, people on the law enforcement and intelligence side, tend to ignore some of the technology arguments against solutions here, because from a technology standpoint, there are no perfect solutions to this one. To what degree did you spend time when you were with the FBI actually meeting with and talking to technologists and trying to really get into the weeds with the technological objections to this? I mean, how well understood do you think they are by people on the DOJ side of this?
Keep in mind, I'm a lawyer, not a technologist, and a lawyer who's worked on a lot of policy issues as well, so I come at it from that perspective, but I'm definitely not a technologist. But no, I personally spent a lot of time with technologists over the years, both in the government and in the private sector, to try to understand the technological perspective as much as I could, and to be sensitive to that. And so I think that at the FBI, we understood pretty well the nature and scope of the problem and the difficulties technologically of solving it, which is why I think we approach this with a fair amount of humility, if I might say, on the technological side, saying we don't have a solution. There's all kinds of very legitimate factors, values, equities here that have to be taken care of, such as protecting cybersecurity, protecting privacy, protecting American competitiveness and innovation and that kind of thing. We recognize those and support them. And we didn't have an easy technological solution, and we didn't want to come forward with one that we thought was sort of half-baked. We just didn't, we didn't have confidence that we had a technological solution, and so we never put one forward. But what we were saying was, we need your help, the technological experts. We need your help in trying to find a solution, knowing that at the end of the day, probably what you're going to end up with is sort of a risk-based type of solution that has some risk associated with it, and the question is whether those are acceptable or not for society.
Mm. Because that's really what it comes down to, isn't it? I mean, the Australian approach here, and I keep talking about this bill because it is an interesting one. You know, the approach seems to be, you know, we want this data. We're not going to tell you how to get it. You just figure it out and get it to us. That seems to be the policy approach here.
Yeah, and that is an approach that has been talked about in the United States as well. And, you know, I think we'll have to see with the Australian law just how effective it is over time. I mean, I think it's not been, my understanding is it's not really been tested yet. And
no.
So we'll have to see. Yeah, we'll see. Have to see how it comes out. And we'll be looking to that absolutely as sort of a canary in the coal mine, sort of beacon or something, whatever analogy you want to use, to see what can be done and see how the companies respond to that and see if there is, it may force action to reveal whether there is a legitimate risk-based approach that could be used to adequately balance all the different equities that are at issue here.
So, I mean, we are supposed to be talking about policy approaches here. I think we've just done a reasonable job of explaining why this is a stalemate, is because we've got to this situation where investigations are suffering, right? People will argue about the degrees to which they're suffering. People will argue about the extent to which that is causing harm to society. People will have that argument. But we can agree that investigations are being impeded by this technology. We can also agree that the solutions here will always come with risks, right? And we can argue about the extent of those risks to privacy, to government overreach, to all of those sorts of things, right? So it does seem like we need to find some way to balance all of this, and that has so far proven to be a policy challenge that is just too great, right? Thus, stalemate. You know, and we've got various governments around the world, New Zealand, Australia, England, passing various acts that, in my mind, the Australian law doesn't insist on, you know, wholesale interception capabilities for end-to-end encrypted messages. That's not what it's about. It's more about forcing tech companies to do piecemeal things that help them under certain sets of circumstances, okay? So where do we go from here, right? If we want to actually get out of this stalemate, it's going to have to be the US. I mean, all of these telecommunications providers or these messaging providers, the bulk of them are based in the United States. The bulk of them operate under United States law. So what's the path forward here? What's the compromise? Because it feels like when you talk to a technologist about this, they say there is no compromise. Any type of action that undermines this chain of trust from providers, you know, issuing signed code to these individual devices and doing end-to-end keying and all of this stuff, it sort of feels like, you know, they're saying you cannot do this without unacceptable risks. And it feels like the government is saying, or government agencies are saying, the risks of doing nothing are too great. So where do we go from here?
Yeah, I wish I had a clean answer for you, but I don't, because the Congress of the United States is just not ready to move yet. There's not a groundswell of sufficient public support to push Congress to change the law. I think there are a lot of people operating in good faith, talking to each other here in the United States, trying to find a policy solution, because what people fear is that Congress won't move until there's some catastrophe that's blamed on encryption. And in that kind of an environment, you'll have a bad choice, because they'll be looking for a quick choice. There are no easy answers here, as we've just described. And so that's one of the fears, I think, that brings a lot of people together who are having meaningful, substantive conversations about this, trying to tackle the hard problems, trying to see if there's a legitimate risk-based way that we can move forward, because we don't want to have to come up with some solution, you know, on the heels of some, you know, dire crisis that we've just been through.
Yeah, you don't want situation where there's an awful attack and then it's just like encryption is banned, right? Because you can sense that you might wind up with some sort of awful outcome like that.
Exactly, because we want to think through carefully the second and third order consequences of any decision we make with encryption. Encryption is so important in protecting privacy. It's so important in protecting national security. It's so important to protecting our economic health and well-being and our ability of our military to operate around the world. We really need solid encryption for lots of very legitimate and good purposes. But encryption has costs, and how do we deal with those costs? That's the fundamental question. And we just haven't figured it out yet. We just have not, as a society, with, again, people operating in good faith, we haven't found a good balance yet.
So how do you begin at chipping away at this? I mean, if you could chip away at one of the problems that is currently faced, and that might be better access to metadata through apps like Signal, Telegram. That might be, content access by dropping provider-supported Trojans onto devices when there's, when we're talking about very serious offences. Like, what? Where's the most pressing need as far as you can see? What is the most pressing issue that you would solve first?
Well, I would continue to try to work on whether there is a viable solution with respect to data on devices, data at rest on devices that the government has already seized pursuant to some type of lawful authority. I would start there because I think the technological issues are more manageable based on everything that I've heard and talking to a lot of technologists on this. It seems as though that's a legitimate way to proceed. The second thing I would say is, yes, we do need to look at metadata. And we need to think about how the government can access metadata, being mindful of the overarching privacy concerns that underlie that as well, right? Because the more metadata you have about people, the more you can understand them, the more you can predict their behavior. And so, especially with tools like artificial intelligence, machine learning, that type of thing, the more metadata you have, the more potentially privacy intrusive it is. So you have to be careful there as well, right? You can't just suck in all the metadata subjected to AI and then, have that be a problem as well.
Of course, but I mean, access to metadata on an individual suspect, I mean, I'd imagine that even would be impossible with some of these apps.
Yes, I mean, making sure that you can get it depends on who the provider is and where the metadata is located. They might be in a different country or something. So yes, getting access to metadata is a problem in certain circumstances that may be just not solvable because of jurisdictional issues, across borders and that kind of thing.
So another question, who are you following on this? Like, who do you look to for interesting work on this policy area?
I'm reluctant to single anybody out in particular, but I am participating in my personal capacity in a working group being led by the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. We put out a few papers about that. I just put out a paper with Susan Landau, who's a professor of computer science at Tufts, and she and I put out a short piece on lawfare, talking about, we're trying to just enhance the level of debate, working with Princeton University, with Carnegie, to try to bring together people to explore what can be explored in a good way, in a robust way. It's really bringing people together from a variety of different, you have to bring people together from industry, from academia, from law enforcement, outside technical experts who don't work for any of those, people at think tanks. It's a whole range of people to have a robust debate that's honest, that's based on the facts, that's not based on, back to your point about marketing and PR, we're really, getting down and wrestling with the hard problems.
Yeah, well, Susan Landau is not really known for being particularly anti-encryption and pro-law enforcement either. So it's an interesting collaboration.
Susan and I have had a great relationship for a long time. We disagree on a lot of different things, but we share common values about how to protect the value and importance of protecting people across a whole range of different threat factors. And the matter is just a question of how we get there. So we've had a great collaboration over the years. But no, Susan is known for that exactly. And I've been, I was the general counsel of the FBI and pushed the law enforcement perspective. But, again, we have to be able to talk to each other if we're going to solve these hard problems.
Hmm. As for countries, outside of the United States, what do you make of the efforts of other countries to try to chip away at this problem? Countries like the UK, countries like Australia, and our subsequent bits of legislation, our subsequent bills. What do you think of those efforts? I mean, are they just bound for failure without the assistance of the United States or compatible laws in the US?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think they're good efforts. I mean, I think you need a lot of creative people from different perspectives trying to work on this problem. And different countries encounter this even more acutely than the United States, is what I've heard repeatedly from our foreign partners, such as Australia, the UK, and Canada, and so on. And so, having different laboratories, if you will, to try to figure out whether there's a way forward makes sense to me, and the urgency and the need is different in these different countries. And so the legislatures the national legislatures in the different places, you know, might have a different inclination to push legislation forward. The question will be at the end of the day, what do the how do the tech companies respond? And, you know, that remains to be seen.
One of the issues, though, isn't it, that I mean, that we've really bumped into over the last couple of years is not just the E2E encryption, but it's the fact that where law enforcement might be able to access tooling at a reasonable cost to get around some of these problems, these days the prices for that stuff are going through the roof. I mean, that's got to factor into this, right?
Yeah, these sort of, you know, people talk about lawful hacking, and which is a term I just don't like, and it's a solution that I just don't think is the right solution for a lot of different reasons. You know, the government has shown, governments around the world have shown their ability with appropriate law, with appropriate lawful process to access devices and, you know, to basically hack into them, right? So, but it's difficult to do. It's way harder than I think people think and recognize. It's a fragile access because if there's a change to the device, if the manufacturer updates the operating system, the solution that you've come up with and may have spent years and lots of money on developing just goes away overnight. It can't be done necessarily quickly. It certainly can't be done at scale, which a lot of people like because they think, well, this is a solution to so that you can't have mass surveillance and so on, which is true because it's difficult to implement this kind of a solution on a significant scale, but it also can't be done quickly necessarily and reliably. And so it creates within law enforcement a huge amount of anxiety because these tools are just not, they're just not reliable in that way.
They're brittle. Yeah. Look, let's,
brittle, exactly.
Let's head towards wrapping this up. Right. And I guess, you know, let's steer the conversation towards what could be a positive arc. Arrests are still being made. Convictions are still being obtained. How successfully have law enforcement organizations like the FBI been able to adapt to a world in which devices are locked and messages are end-to-end encrypted? Is it the case that you've been able to adapt your workflows, your investigative processes to offset what was initially considered a catastrophic development? You know, I mean, how effectively was the FBI able to get around a lot of this stuff with just different investigative techniques?
So I guess there's a couple answers to that. One is it is basically impossible to quantify that and give you a meaningful answer that actually reflects what's happening in reality. I don't think that can be done. That's number one. Number two is, as I said earlier, encryption does impact investigations. You know, it doesn't impact all of them the same way. And it doesn't have it just doesn't play out in the same way across the board, but it does have an impact. Very difficult to measure, and I'm not going to sit here and say that I can do that. The other thing, though, is investigators, the FBI, other law enforcement, national security agencies around the world are basically relentless. And so when they are trying to protect the people that they're sworn to protect, they will run into obstacles all the time, and they don't give up. And so this is an obstacle. Encryption in many circumstances is an obstacle. And so, you know, the FBI and others look for ways to deal with that. Okay, we can't get this type of data because we're not going to stop if we think there's a threat or, you know, we're trying to solve a crime. They are persistent and try to do other things. But it does have an impact. It slows them down, and it may mean that they miss leads and they may not be able to resolve cases in the end. But it's not in a sense that I can quantify that's going to make you or the critics satisfied.
So I guess where we're leaving this is your fear is that it's going to take a catastrophic event for Congress to move on this, and you hope that it's not the case. That's kind of where you've arrived, isn't it?
That's absolutely yes. I hope that is not the case. People are working hard to try to figure out if there's a solution. Nobody's giving up on the problem, but it just seems like a legislative solution at this particular time, at least in the United States, is not in the cards. It's not on the horizon. And so we're going to work hard to make sure that there is no catastrophe, but it gets harder with each day because encryption continues to spread around through different types of platforms and so on. That has substantial benefits for society. It also produces a series of risks for society as well.
Jim Baker, thank you so much for joining us on Risky Business to have this conversation. It's been illuminating and, it's been very interesting. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
All right. That was R Street's Jim Baker, the former general counsel of the Federal Bureau of Investigation in the United States. Big thanks to Jim Baker for sharing his time with us for that conversation. And big thanks to the Hewlett Foundation for making this podcast possible. I'll be back soon. I'm off on leave for a couple of weeks. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.